We make greater efforts in our society to celebrate difference than we once did. A culture that once featured laws to keep people with deformities from appearing in public has changed over time. But there's still a basic level of discomfort with people who are born different from the bulk of society. Yet, not only do they learn from us, but we learn a lot from them as well. These are the people that Andrew Solomon considers in his book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew Solomon has written several books and a number of articles for the New York Times Magazine and The New Yorker. He's an activist and philanthropist in LGBT rights, mental health, education, and the arts, and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Andrew Solomon, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
You start with a story about being assigned to investigate deaf culture for the New York Times. What was the story there?
It was about 20 years ago, and my editors at the magazine wanted me to write about deaf culture. And I was very taken aback. I had no idea there was any such thing as deaf culture. I thought deafness was a disability and mostly a tragedy. And then I went out into the deaf world and met people who used sign language as their primary means of communication and came to understand that for them, deafness really was membership in a very tight and in some ways very beautiful community.
One that they really didn't want speaking people in? I mean, how were their feelings about the people who did try to speak with people spoken language?
Well, the politics of the deaf community were complicated. I wouldn't say that they didn't want people who weren't speaking, but it was a world organized around the shared use of sign language, and so signing was very central. Some of them had a political stance that it was sort of better to be authentically in touch with who you were as a deaf person and to acknowledge your deafness and to communicate in sign language, and they felt that people who were using oral speech were trying to ape the ways of non-deaf people and were not really authentically and fully deaf and not living in the deaf world. They made a distinction between deaf with a lowercase d, which refers to not being able to hear, and deaf with an uppercase D, which refers to being a member of this deaf culture, this very vibrant deaf culture with its own poetry, its own theater, its own social organizations, its own status in the world.
This is quite an awakening for you, it sounds like.
It was a complete revelation to me. And then as I went along, I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, and that those parents, by and large, focus on oral speech at that time and lip reading and trying to get them to function in the oral world. And a lot of them discover this radical deaf culture in adolescence when it comes as a great liberation. And I wrote at the time about how similar I thought the experience was to my experience as the gay child of straight parents, who, like most gay children, had grown up in a family that wanted me more or less to assimilate and to be part of the mainstream world, and who then found that sense of liberation when I discovered that there was actually a gay culture out there. I thought there was a strong parallel, and it really shocked me because, as I say, when I went in, I thought of deafness as being nothing but, you know, a terrible problem.
Well, and then in addition to studying deaf culture and then reflecting upon your own experiences as a gay man, but then some friends had a dwarf child. Was there a eureka moment here when the overall idea of exceptionalism hit you?
There was, and it was in fact tied to the experience of Lisa Headley and her daughter, who is a dwarf. She was a friend of a friend, and I started hearing her talk about all of the questions she was facing. Should she raise her child to think she was just like everyone else, only shorter? Or should she somehow try to get her daughter some feeling of dwarf identity? Should she get involved in the Little People of America? Should she give her contact with other dwarfs? Should she help to kind of construct this? And she talked about how confused she was about what the best way forward was. And in that moment, I suddenly thought, it's exactly like the deaf thing. And the deaf thing was exactly like the gay thing. And it must be something that occurs elsewhere, where you have a family that sees itself as essentially normal, with a child who is extraordinary or exceptional in some very profound way and has to make accommodation to that child. And that was the seed of the book. I thought, if it's happened for deafness and it's happened for dwarfism and it's happened for gayness, there must be a lot of other kinds of exceptionalism that families are suddenly given when they have a child that have no relation to anything that they'd imagined when they set out to have children.
You probably could have started with several dozen, if not several hundred, different ways to identify people differently who were raising children with these differences. How did you manage to narrow the list to what you ended up with?
Well, I had to narrow the list just because the book is quite chunky, even as it is, and I didn't want it to be a sort of seven-volume series.
Right.
And what I did when I was trying to narrow the scope of things, because I did come up with over 100 categories that I thought about including, I tried to do categories that didn't repeat one another too much. So the issues of being blind are quite different from the issues of being deaf, but similar enough so that if I had a chapter on the deaf, I didn't do one on the blind. And I tried to choose chapters that made a kind of constellation and showed the full range of experience that it was possible to have. So I ended up with deafness, dwarfism, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, multiple severe disabilities, with a chapter on families of prodigies who are also quite overwhelmed, one on parents bringing up children conceived in rape, one on families of people who commit crimes, and one on families of people who are transgender. And I felt that those ultimately were representative of the full range of issues that I'd encountered. But I let go of some of the other topics with sadness.
And it still ended up a very big book at 700 pages or so, and yet hard to put down. Far from the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity is the work of Andrew Solomon in an interview from a few years ago. We'll come back to that interview in a minute 15 here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Andrew Solomon wrote a very big book on children born different in categories ranging from Down syndrome to prodigies. Far from the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity won a pile of awards for the book, and the author joined us to talk about it in late 2013. The book, not the awards. We pick up the conversation now with the reminder that as compelling as the subject is, the interview is pre-recorded, so we can't take any new phone calls today. I mean, obviously, Andrew Solomon, you point out we all deal with similar issues in even describing these identities, and not defects we're calling them here, but why do you say the replacement terms are nearly as pejorative?
I'm sorry, why do I say the...
The replacement terms are nearly as pejorative. In other words, the things that we say to try to be nicer than what we used to say.
Well, I've only said that we are constantly emphasizing how different other people are from us. So some of the replacement terms are obviously less pejorative. You know, gay describes a culture as opposed to homosexual, which was historically the term for an illness. So there is some shift there. But I said that a lot of the time we continue to come up with a nicer way to describe people as sick, and that often what people really experience within these conditions that from the outside look like sicknesses is a sense of identity. And that I think it's important to come up with the idea that each of these conditions can be described in negative terms as an illness or can be described in more positive terms as an identity. The fact that it's an identity doesn't make it a desirable identity, but it means that for the people who are living this difference, this form of difference, they may actually have quite a rich experience of their lives. So I met people who were dwarfs, for instance, who really felt that their being dwarfs had given them access to a whole group of people who had become their friends, had led to the marriages they had led to the lives they had, and who couldn't find it in themselves to regret those lives. And I met parents of children who had many very unusual circumstances who said things like, "When I found out my child had Down syndrome, I cried, but now I feel lucky because I feel it's been such a special experience and I love my child so much." And I just wanted to get away from some of the sense that we're using sort of polite words to describe everything in negative terms and say, what would it be like to look at some of these things and say they can be very rewarding and see them in these more positive identity terms?
When you talk about identities, too, you led us into some terms I hadn't seen before, vertical identities and horizontal ones. What are those?
You hadn't seen them before because I came up with them.
Ah, there you go.
There we are.
Well done.
So I said that vertical identities are identities that are handed down generationally from parent to child. So your ethnicity is a vertical identity, your nationality, usually your language, often your religion. There are many ways in which it can be difficult to have those vertical identities. They can be burdensome and troubling, but nobody is trying to fix them. So you could say that in this country it's still easier to be white than it is to be a person of color, the current presidency notwithstanding, but nobody is trying to cure the next generation of children born to African-American, Latino, or Asian parents so they come out with blonde hair and blue eyes. But then there are what I call horizontal identities. Horizontal because they aren't handed down from parent to child, but are instead learned from a peer group. There's something that you have that's different from your parents. And by and large, parents don't reinforce those identities. Instead, they have tried to cure them, and the society at large has tried to cure them. And it takes those people a much longer time to come to a sense of peacefulness in those identities. So identities like being gay or like being a dwarf or like being a criminal, which is not such a great identity, but really does function as an identity, or like being transgender and so on and so forth.
Back to your title, we're talking about people who go against the old adage about the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, but the people that you profiled, and you talked to hundreds, it seems like, of people.
I did. I talked to about 300 families.
Wow. And in these cases, the children really did fall far from the tree.
They fell far from the tree in some profound and specific way. But what was interesting was that often, once the parents really came to terms with the way their children were far from the tree, they were able to understand the ways in which they were not so far from the tree. So having a child who has autism means having a child who's very different in some ways from the parents. It can be a terrible trauma for the parents, but it can also be the case that as the parents adjust to the idea that they have a child with autism, they begin bit by bit to find how much they in fact have in common with that child and how much joy there can be in their relationship with him.
How much did you find that that parents beat themselves up for the issues that their kids are born with?
Parents blame themselves all the time. I was very struck by a conversation I had one day with someone who said to me, she said, you know, the real reason my son has autism, it's my fault. And I said, it's your fault? And she said, I went skiing when I was pregnant. And I said, yes. And she said, well, the altitude isn't good for the developing fetus. And I thought, okay, there are about 12,000 reasons that have been floated around for why people develop autism, but that isn't one of them. I thought parents so often feel guilty, and the way that they express or experience their guilt is by blaming themselves all the time. And it comes out of a long history of parents being blamed. You know, we used to say that overbearing mothers made for gay kids, and that refrigerator mothers made for kids with autism, and that fathers who wish their children didn't exist caused them to become schizophrenic, and so on and so forth. And I just think that this issue of causality has poisoned the waters and has made the relationships between parents and children very difficult. I interviewed Jim Watson, the guy who discovered the structure of DNA of Watson and Crick, and he has a son who's schizophrenic. And referring to the mid-century psychiatrist who said that parents called schizophrenia, he said, the most evil person of the 20th century after Adolf Hitler was Bruno Bettelheim.
And what did he do?
He was the mid-century psychiatrist who had said that parents caused schizophrenia.
Oh, the parents caused it. Right. Okay. So, yeah. In fact, I remember hearing from my own father like that homosexuality is caused generally by a dominant mother and a weak father.
Right. So as we consider those things, the parents are so caught up in these narratives of blame that they can't step back and get any perspective on who their children really are. And we've gradually, as a society, begun to drop those blaming explanations, and we've more and more accepted the idea that a lot of this stuff is genetics or epigenetics or something else that we don't understand, but that these differences are not caused by parental behavior. And that's liberated parents to say, okay, I wouldn't have chosen to have a child with this difference, but I do have a child with this difference, and what can I do to make his life a good one and mine?
So we have reached a level of acceptance now, but it is a far cry from what used to be the case. I mean, a lot of the people in the categories that you chose for the book, would they have been institutionalized, say, before 1960?
Oh, a lot of them would have been institutionalized, absolutely. And a lot of them would have lived out their lives in these grim institutions and never lived up to anything like their potential. I mean, I'm struck, for instance, by the area of Down syndrome. In 1968, the Atlantic Monthly ran an article that said, there is no reason to feel guilty about putting a Down syndrome child away, whether it is put away in the sense of hidden in a sanitarium or in a more responsible, lethal sense. It is sad, yes, dreadful, but it carries no guilt. True guilt arises only from a crime against a person, and a Downs is not a person. Now, for them to have written that in 1968, it sounds pretty shocking to modern ears. People with Down syndrome now live more than twice as long as they did in 1968. instead of living in those institutions where they gradually fade away and die. Some of them have careers, some of them are writers, some of them are actors. The change in their lives, the degree to which they can live independently, the things they can accomplish were unimaginable then. And it took our having a sort of leap of the imagination to be able to understand that people with Down syndrome had enormous potential, enormous unrealized potential, and the lives they live are so radically better than the lives they used to live. There are hardly words for it.
Andrew Solomon is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about these various sets of conditions that some people are born with that Andrew talks about in his book and how we've really changed society in response to the fact that we accept these people as people now. Because you just heard Atlantic in 1968, Down syndrome people, not people. That's amazing to me. I'll even venture a guess that the Atlantic article probably used the old term for Down syndrome. Which I won't repeat.
I think it used the term Down syndrome in parts, but it used that that negative mongoloid word crept in there, too.
Wow. It's just amazing. I mean, in fact, one of the things that I found really shocking in the book was that we referred to in the intro here was that Chicago had a law hiding deformed people on the books until 1973.
Yes, they should not make themselves visible where it will constitute a public nuisance. It basically said if you were so ugly that people didn't like looking at you or so deformed as to be disturbing that you should be physically hidden away.
That's some amazing stuff. I want to go into some of the categories themselves now. You started with deafness in the book. We talked a little bit about deaf culture and small d and capital D deaf. Cochlear implants, I noticed, have been quite a bit of a disruptor in the deaf world. Why?
Well, the question often with each of these categories is whether the people who are in them would like to be cured. And often the people within these categories initially in life think, I have a disability, I have a difference, it's very difficult, I wish I were like everyone else. And later say, this has made me who I am. This is the life I've had. My struggles have been full of meaning. I'm glad to be part of the community I belong to. The cochlear implant is a device that can be surgically implanted in the brain and connected to a transmitter, allowing sound to bypass the structures of the ear and go directly to the brain sound center. So it effectively gives people some sort of version of hearing, people who are completely deaf. And when it first came along, the people who were part of the signing deaf culture with its history of deaf schools, with its deaf theater, all the other deaf things that it had, were very disturbed by it and said that this represents a kind of genocidal move. And they said, people talk about how we'll be able to eliminate deafness because deafness is so stigmatized. How would we feel about eliminating blackness because blackness is stigmatized? It's really the same thing. And there are arguments in both directions. I mean, on the one hand, deafness is a disability. People with deafness require a lot of accommodations that are given to people with disabilities. There are many difficulties associated with being deaf, and deaf people don't get to hear music, and they aren't able to communicate fluently with much of the mainstream population. On the other hand, this deaf culture is a very vital and a very beautiful culture, and in some ways a very seductive one. When I was at the National Association of the Deaf meeting, I remember having moments of thinking, gee, I wish I were deaf. Not in the sense that I wished that I couldn't hear anymore because I like my hearing, but in the sense that it was such a vibrant culture and I was sad not to be able to be a full participant in it. And so the cochlear implant, in any event, represented the idea of deafness being eliminated. And the people who had spent their entire lives as part of the deaf world felt as though they were under a kind of genocidal attack.
Okay, there is that word again, genocide. Is that an outlier opinion in the community, or was that a fairly broad one?
The opinion in the community has softened a great deal. The cochlear implant exists. Deaf culture continues to exist. Sign language is now one of the most taught languages on college campuses, so many people who aren't deaf are learning sign language. There's a different relationship to all of these things. But when it first came along, the word genocide got used a great deal, and it still gets used by people at the more extreme end of the movement.
Is there any part of the world, Andrew, that approaches the issues of deafness very differently from the way we handle it in the United States?
Well, I wrote about a sort of funny, odd thing in the book, which is that there's a village in northern Bali where there's been a hereditary form of deafness that's been present in the village for at least 300 years, and where everybody who lives in the village, because it's a recessive gene and can show up anywhere in any family, everyone in the village knows sign language. And I went off and spent some time there, and what I discovered is that in a place where everyone knows sign language, people's deafness isn't really very much of an issue. I would say to people, is so-and-so deaf or not deaf? And people would say, wait a minute, let me think. Oh, I think he's deaf. And they'd be talking about their own cousin or their own friend. It just didn't register very much which language system you were using with which person.
Because they didn't know, because they were always using sign language.
Right.
Right. Okay. Into the chapter on dwarfs, Harry Weider, who was he?
Harry Weider was someone who had an awful lot of issues to deal with. He was a deaf, disabled, he had to use a walker, frequently incontinent gay dwarf, who was the sole child of Holocaust survivors, and he was up against incredible difficulties and challenges in his life, and he managed to rise to them and to become a force in New York City politics. When he died tragically, he was run over in an accident. All of the heads of New York City and some New York State politics showed up for his funeral. He was someone who just seemed to have everything running against him, and who nonetheless had quite an amazing and quite a thrilling life. And I loved what his mother said to the New York Times reporter who came to talk to her when Harry had died. He said, you know, did you worry about Harry? And she said, I worried all the time about him putting himself out into the world in so many ways. I wanted him to lead a quiet life where no one would notice him and all of his problems, she said. But in spite of my best efforts, I could not hold back the good in him.
Huh. That is a great comment. And when did Harry Weider die?
2.5 years ago, I think.
Okay, I'm just trying to figure out at which point in history that he made his impact. So it was still fairly recent. I mean, something that might not have been possible 20 or 30 years earlier.
Oh, I don't think it would have been possible 20 or 30 years earlier. In all the areas I'm looking at, there have been radical changes. There have been radical changes because we're a more accepting society. The way we hear that quote about Down syndrome and are startled by it should give us evidence of how much our attitude toward difference and disability has changed, especially since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act and the integration of disabled people in the educational system, both of which I think have been absolutely huge.
In the chapter on dwarfs, again, Anna Adelson and the reactions of medical staff to her birth, these were rather, you know, there's a fair number of shocking episodes here in the book, and this is just one of them.
Well, Anna Adelson was born, her parents were told, as were many of the parents of many of the children in this book, that they should leave their child at the hospital and not take their child home. Anna is now in her 30s, so that was happening some time ago, and they were told, you know, she was going to have this terrible problem and that there were homes to take care of children like that. And her mother took her home and really loved her and paid attention to her and helped her to develop into an amazing woman. She actually, both the mother and the daughter happened to be friends of mine. And her mother said to me at one point, she said, well, you know, if someone had given me an interview to do and said, how'd you like to give birth to a lesbian dwarf? I wouldn't have ticked that box. But she's Anna, cornerstone of the family. I wish the path had not been so steep for her, but I'm so glad she managed to climb it with grace.
I'm struck again by the reactions, and I have to presume these lasted for decades, if not hundreds of years, where parents would fight off their own parental instincts, particularly the mothers, the maternal instincts, and just recoil in fear or revulsion or something to their own children.
You know, the eugenics movement in the early part of the 20th century was really what hatched that. So if you look in the 19th century, there wasn't as much of that response. And then in the early 20th century, there was the understanding that whatever defect someone had came through hereditary lines. And so people who had children who were flawed or defective were considered themselves to be flawed or defective and to be somehow lesser by virtue of having produced these troubled children. And that, I think, was a very poisonous idea. And it made people feel not only sad for whatever difficulties their children felt, but also ashamed. And that shame was the terrible poison of these families for decades. And now we've finally gotten over that idea, and we live in the era of the internet when people can find community around them.
Much more to learn from Andrew Solomon's rigorous research and hundreds of interviews. The book is called Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And you'll hear the rest of the interview when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Andrew Solomon took a good hard look at children born different from societal norms in ways ranging from autism to dwarfism to deafness. The result of his exhaustive research was the book Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew Solomon joined us to discuss it in late 2013, and we return to the rest of that interview now with a reminder that since it's pre-recorded, we're not taking any new phone calls or emails today. Let's settle in for a second on rape. You say children conceived in rape get as rough a start as a child with dwarfism or Down syndrome. Why?
I wanted in the book to examine the idea that this issue of illness and identity, which exists in the arena of the first six examples that I came up with in the book of things we've always treated as illnesses, also exists in the realm of things that are more socially constructed. And I wanted to show that the challenge for a parent to loving his or her own child can be caused by the condition that child has. My child has autism. It's harder to love an autistic child. It's more confusing. It's more overwhelming. It's more bewildering. It's more uncertain. It can also be caused by where the child comes from, a child conceived in rape, or what the child does, which is why I included a chapter on crime. And I think for parents who have children conceived in rape, a lot of the time, they struggle a lot between the reality that this is their child and they love their child and the concern that this child is constantly reminding them of something horrific and traumatic that happened to them when they were younger. And so what do they do with the sense of horror and the sense of celebration that come together in that situation? And how do parents manage to, how do they manage to be good parents to these children who at some level frighten or repulse them? You know, one mother said to me, other mothers, when they don't know what to do, can rely on their instincts. But my instincts are horrifying, and I fight against them every day.
What kind of instincts did she have?
Well, she had instincts of being angry at her child because her child really reminded her in many ways of the person who had raped her. Now, most of the parents I was writing about had ultimately managed to find their way past that that standpoint, but they had mostly gone through it. There was one woman I interviewed who had a child who had been conceived in rape. She had been brutally raped when she was 16 by two men behind a sort of subway stop in New York City. And I said to her, when she was now in her 50s, I said, well, what do you think about them very much? And she said, you know, I used to think about them with anger and hatred. She said, but now I think about them with pity. And I said, pity? I said, because they're so unevolved as human beings and did something like this? And she said, no. She said, because one of them has a beautiful daughter and two beautiful grandchildren, and he doesn't know that, and I do. So as it turns out, I'm the lucky one.
Wow. It's amazing. I can imagine this particular group of people was probably the hardest to find, though.
They were very hard to find. I had to persuade the people who run notice boards online for people who've been raped to agree to let me post ads and requests for information. People like that are, of course, suspicious of strange middle-aged males who come along with a lot of questions
right.
For the women on their site. But I was amazed at how many women actually did write to me in the end and how many of them I was in touch with and how very painful their stories were, but how eager they were to tell those stories because they said, as mothers in many of the other chapters did, I felt very alone in these experiences. And if telling my story to you will help someone else to feel less alone, then I think it's well worth doing. And I've had a bunch of correspondence since the book came out from people saying they recently had this experience and found the chapter did make them feel less alone. So it's working.
The children themselves of rape, do they often know in most of the cases you talk to from a very early age, or is it something that's they're given the information later in life? How's that generally handled?
You know, it's incredibly tricky. If you adopt a child, the wisdom is that you're supposed to tell your child that he's adopted from very early on before he can really even understand it. But rape is a very disturbing idea, and to tell a tiny little child about it involves more sex and violence than most people want to introduce into the life of a small child. So then there's always the question of when to tell your child. And I met people who said they were told too early and that it was too upsetting and they weren't old enough to deal with it. And I met people who said they were told too late and that they felt they'd formed an identity and learning this halfway through their lives had been incredibly destructive for them. So there isn't really any generally agreed upon right time to tell. And the question of when or whether to tell was one that haunted all of the mothers I talked to.
Are there any particular differences for the children of rape from the rest of society in anything like academic achievement or anything like that? I mean, since the trauma happened before they were born, leading to their birth, obviously. I mean, anything that makes them stand apart from society in any achievement or lack of achievement, I guess.
Anecdotally, I encountered more kids with academic challenges and so on, but I think those aren't caused by the fact that they were children of rape. They were caused by the fact that their parents had had to struggle to establish the relationship to them, and also that often their parents were single mothers who had never intended to get pregnant and weren't ready to have children, or people who faced enormous economic struggles or a social exclusion on the basis of having the children they did and so on and so forth. I think the explanation lies in social circumstances and not in the simple fact of being a child of rape. But having said that, there were also a number of people I met. And there was one who really came. Her parents were poor. Her mother was brutally raped. She was born, and she was just determined to get into a better life, and she ended up being quite a successful lawyer. And so there's no question that these people have the capacity, or at least many of them have the capacity, to do extraordinary things.
Andrew Solomon is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. There is a quotation in the book, just a total reprinting in the book, actually, of Emily Pearl Kingsley's Welcome to Holland. Tell us a bit about it, please.
Emily Pearl Kingsley is a writer for Sesame Street who had a child with Down syndrome. She was very taken aback when her child was born, and she wrote something about the experience of bringing up such a child. And she said, you get pregnant, and it's as if you're planning a trip to Italy where all your friends are going. And then you get on the plane, and right before you land, the flight attendant comes on and says, welcome to Holland. And you say, Holland? I didn't mean to go to Holland. I was going to Italy. And all your life, your friends will go and come from Italy, and you'll be envious of them. But where you've gone is not a place of complete desolation. And if you can appreciate that Holland has windmills, and Holland has tulips, and Holland even has Rembrandts, then you can discover the beauties of Holland, which are different from the beauties of Italy. And the pain of not going to Italy will be with you, but you can really enjoy Holland. And she describes this experience of having a child with a disability as being like Holland. She says, it's not where you intended to go, it's not where you wanted to go, and you may always feel a little sad about it, but it's actually quite a beautiful place in its own right. I must say this episode did not go down so well in the Dutch translation of my book, but in all other contexts it has.
Right. Let us take a call here. We have Deb in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Solomon, the author of Far From the Tree.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Thank you so much for taking the call. This is a wonderful discussion. I just wanted to really make a comment. My daughter has Down syndrome. We live here in the local area, and she has done, you know, remarkably well. We've long known the history behind people with Down syndrome, and I think my husband and I, when she was born, just decided right off the bat that she would be no different than any of our other children and that we would treat her no differently. And, you know, she has had great success in school here in Oregon. She did run up against an unfortunate situation at SOU because she wanted to take a class at SOU and ended up getting dismissed from the local university. She went on to give a speech that I wanted to just make you aware of. It's on her blog at www.elizashoff.com. And the last name is spelled, it's E-L-I-Z-A and then S-C-H-A-A-F. And on that blog on the right-hand side, there's Eliza's speech from June 1st, 2011. And it really, I think, very accurately describes why she wanted to go to college, that she had the skills to do it, but that the world hasn't quite gotten ready for people with Down syndrome and all that they can achieve. She has gone on since then and graduated this last June from Highline Community College in Washington. So she lives now in Ashland, has her own apartment, and is doing great. But I just wanted to sort of throw that out there to your listeners and really thank you for everything that you've written in your book, because I think your book epitomizes what more and more people need to come to an understanding about people who are different.
All right. Thanks for the call, Deb. Appreciate it. And we'll make sure we put up a Facebook link to ElizaShoff.com. Thoughts, Andrew?
I am very touched and honored. Thank you for those kind words. And I think just what you've described, your daughter is doing involved in a civil rights fight. This is the civil rights fight of our generation. You know, we had the women's movement and the fight for racial civil rights. Then we had the gay movement, which has now really made a lot of progress. And now we need to have these movements for people with disabilities and differences. If it had been 50 years ago, the idea of your daughter having her own apartment and having graduated from college would have been unimaginable. And you must have been a terrific parent to be able to see that potential in her and to be able to bring it out to the surface.
I was shocked just a few short years ago to meet a woman who also had a Down syndrome child, who explained that until about 5 years before that, so this would have been about 10 years ago, the general trend was there's no point in teaching children with Down syndrome to read, which just brought me up short. I guess I'd never thought about that before. And that has changed, hasn't it?
The assumption for a long time was that there was no point teaching people with Down syndrome anything because they weren't really going to be able to do anything with it. And it was the active mothers who decided to go off and give their Down syndrome children, their children with Down syndrome, some kind of education that really started it. Emily Pearl Kingsley, we talked about a minute ago, helped to come up with the idea that giving your children as much sensory stimulation as possible as early as you could made a difference. She covered her son's room with bright colors and mobiles, and she gave him a bath in Jell-O and another bath in popcorn so he could feel the textures, and she did all of these stimulating things. It became part of the early intervention movement, and the early intervention movement has been a movement to say these kids are actually capable of much more than we ever thought, and teach them as much as you can and see where they'll go. Now, some people have higher functioning Down syndrome and some people lower functioning, and I wouldn't want to stigmatize the ones who can't do all of these things. But I'd want to say that as a society for a long time, we took people with enormous potential and we refused to realize that. And now I think we're beginning to realize how much those people actually can contribute and how much they enrich the lives of all of us. As one father of someone with Down syndrome said, "Well, I'd like to spare my son the difficulties he's experienced as a result of Down syndrome. I really believe if we eliminated Down syndrome from the world, we'd eliminate some of what it is to be human."
And yet there's a phrase in the book, and it's not in the chapter about Down syndrome specifically, but about, you write that all people are objects and perpetrators of prejudice. And you go on to talk about some people who you met who were okay with the murder of Dr. George Tiller, the abortion doctor in Kansas.
Yes, I was rather shocked by that. But of course, there are people who are strongly opposed to abortion, and these were people who said that they thought abortion was an evil and a wrong, and who themselves had a child who was transgender and who kept talking about how much they wanted acceptance for their child. And I said, okay, but acceptance has to come everywhere. If you want acceptance for your child, there perhaps has to be acceptance that other people have different ideas about abortion. And while you certainly should never be under pressure to have one, you should accept that someone else might. But they were a very striking couple. They weren't very well educated. They didn't have economic means. They had a child who was transgender. They didn't understand how the system worked. They didn't know what they were supposed to do. And they lost their child for a period of 2.5 years to social services on grounds that they, as lesbian mothers with a transgender child, must be doing something horribly wrong. And it was only when some people from the outside heard through the church they went to about what was going on that they were ultimately able to win back their child.
Andrew Solomon, you write that that writing the book addressed a sadness within you. It was over what and what effect did the process have?
You know, I think I, when I was growing up, had been very sad about being gay. I sort of wanted to be perfect in every way and to please my parents 100%. And I experienced being gay as a failure, and I felt that I wasn't pleasing my parents in the ways that I'd have hoped. And I felt I wasn't the person I wanted to be in some sense. And then as I worked on the book, I thought, actually, lots of people have lots of kinds of differences, and we discover dignity in them, and once we've discovered it, it's there. And I became less annoyed at my parents about their lack of immediate acceptance, because I realized that acceptance is a choice and it takes people a long time to get there. And I became more relaxed in some way about accepting myself and thinking lives that are marked by difference are not necessarily lesser lives. They're just different lives.
Which is the big message overall. And how long did you spend on the project?
11 years.
All right. Well done. Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew Solomon, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It's been a huge pleasure.